From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. And specifically, can you name all five freedoms protected by the First Amendment? A survey from the Annenberg Public Policy Institute found that only 1 in 20 Americans, 5%, could name all five freedoms protected by the First Amendment. Roughly 35% of Americans don't know the three branches of the federal government. As history professor Michael Oberg says, these are surface-level facts. This is not necessarily a complex understanding of American civics we're talking about. The reality is that American civic and governmental literacy has reached illiteracy, I should say, has reached the highest level on measure. Many of your fellow citizens don't know basic facts about how this country was founded and how it is supposed to operate. And that last point is key here. Look around your neighborhood, your town, your community. Think about the civic foundation of this country, and then look at how the ideals are being applied or not applied. What looks right to you? What does not? Students at SUNY Geneseo are about to get a new opportunity to study American civics more deeply and then apply lessons to their hometowns. The American Cornerstones Project is designed to give students a meaningful understanding of American ideals. Students who complete the program will receive a micro-credential in American democracy and civic engagement. But before they're done, they've got to take what they have learned back to their hometowns and conduct research into how the American experiment is being carried out, for good or for ill. Can this work? I mean, is this a good way to kind of pull us forward, understand American government, history, facts, civic literacy? Maybe it'll work on this cohort. Maybe we all should learn something from this. We want to know what the students will be asked to read and to study, and we asked our guest to kind of come in and explain. And Michael Oberg is a distinguished professor in the Department of History at SUNY Geneseo. This will not be the first conversation on civic literacy on this program. I'm sure it won't be the last either. Welcome back to the program, Michael.
Thank you, Evan.
Hannah Brandt is here, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at SUNY Geneseo. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And with us as well is Kathleen Mapes. Kathy is chair of the Department of History at SUNY Geneseo. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Michael reached out to me a number of weeks back, and obviously we planned this conversation not knowing that we'd be coming in on a Monday after a weekend marked by political violence and a near assassination of a former and perhaps a candidate who could be the next president. And I mean, I don't even know what to ask you, Michael, other than you're an optimist in some ways, and I think you try to be a realist in many ways. Does this shake your optimism about the American experiment?
That's a heavy question. I worry about what can happen in the near term in response to the assassination attempt on former President Trump. I worry that we will see proscription of certain types of speech. I think we're seeing that already coming out in some of the statements from members of the Republican Party that this is a product of Democrats equating President Trump with fascism and things like that. What I thought about after this happened was, man, we really got it. Get back to basics, and we've got to talk about what this Constitution says, what it means, how it's supposed to operate. The Constitution, by no means, is a perfect document. I think in some ways it has deep and important flaws, but it is the rule book. It is the template on which government is based, and I think that we feel it's very important. A couple weeks ago, Chancellor John King, who runs the entire SUNY system, and for your listeners, that's our college. It's the four big universities. It's the medical schools, community college. It's a massive system, one of the biggest systems in the country. He issued a call and said that the SUNY colleges should include civics education in their curricula, right? It should be part of their education. We at Geneseo could not agree more. And I think in a lot of ways, we at Geneseo are ahead of the chancellor on this. And that's what's exciting and I think is really energizing for me about this American Cornerstones Project is we see a problem in American society. We see rampant civic illiteracy across the political spectrum, right, amongst our students. And how possibly can citizens protect their rights, their liberties, their freedoms if they don't know what those freedoms are? So we feel very that this is an important project, is dealing with an important subject, and it will benefit our students. And ultimately, when the students take this work home, it'll benefit all of us. That's the goal. We'll see how it works out beginning in 6 weeks when I start teaching.
get some time. No, I'm really looking forward to this conversation this hour and learning about what the students are going to be learning about. Kathy, do you want to weigh in on how you were feeling this weekend with this horrible story unfolding?
I'm a little less optimistic, and I fear that it's not just a question of kind of civic illiteracy, but the inability to speak to each other, care for each other, to have some kind of common ground. So in terms of thinking about this course, obviously the texts are important, the historical context is important, but I also think what's important is being able to engage in dialogue and debate, because we don't expect all the students to necessarily agree, but we expect them to take issues seriously and to take each other seriously. So I wish I could be as optimistic, but I, as a historian of the first half of the 20th century, this feels... a little bit like the 1930s, and that scares me.
I hesitate to ask this, but do you contemplate what would have happened had he been killed, had that bullet been 2 inches to the right? I think it would be very different today already.
I do. I have to say that I don't think I have. It still feels surreal to me
now. Yeah, I understand that.
I feel like our politics has become a caricature of things, and so it's hard to kind of fully process this event. I think that's going to take some time, and I think that I'm also waiting to see how whether or not this is just like Gabby Gifford and, you know, there's a moment of stepping back and then we're right back in the ring of vilifying each other. And I fear that's likely to be the case.
Hannah, do you want to weigh in too there?
I think that it makes something like the American Cornerstones Project all the more important. I'm eager to get back in the classroom and learn from our students, process with them. Kind of, I feel similar sentiments as Kathy. I wish I was more optimistic like Michael, but it made me really eager to get back to our community this semester and navigate this certainly historical moment.
Well, part of what animates Michael Oberg's optimism, as he has said on this program numerous times over the years, is you really bristle when people stereotype young adults, college students, students in general. And you've said many times how impressed you are by your students and how thoughtful they are as people. You still feel that way?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I will argue with anyone about this, right? They you know, I think that there are deficiencies in the way they are educated in the K-12 system. I think that the students we have today are different than the students that we have past, but we teach the students we have, not the students that we once had. And that requires, I think, successful educators to constantly be on their toe. And what I see are students who at times are deeply cynical. They are concerned about the environment, about owning a home, about the economy, and all kinds of things like that. But I also see students who believe profoundly that things can change and that they can bring about those changes. And my generation, we haven't been very good at this. I have a lot of hope in younger people to do this. I really do.
Kathy, is that a place where you agree with Michael? Does that give you some optimism?
Definitely. It definitely does. I, too, really bristle at the previous students were like this or former generations. I don't believe in greatest generations. I believe in generations. And I think we need to recognize that this generation has really been through the ringer. You know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, they lost time with COVID. Perhaps their parents had lost jobs in 2008. They live in an uncertain world. And so I remind myself that when I was coming of age in the 70s and 80s, everything seemed possible. And I think for them, it's a matter of meeting them where they're at and helping to further empower them. And I think they grab onto that because they don't want to give up on their lives or their country or this planet at this moment. So I'm very optimistic. I think that they're often very kind and very sensitive, and that's often used against them as snowflakes or weaklings. And instead, I think that they have a lot of empathy. And it's a matter of kind of cultivating it and bringing that out into the open.
Hannah, you agree with that? I mean, do the students at least give you some hope?
They really do. And I mean, as a younger millennial myself, I feel a little bit closer to them and with them in the trenches, so to speak. But they inspire me.
Hannah is the resident youngest person on this panel, in this room, and that's okay. But let's ask all of our guests to describe at the outset here. I mean, I did my best to kind of talk about the American Cornerstones Project, but I want to ask Michael first what the genesis was. And if this works, you know, what does it really look like? And then we're going to kind of get into the text and how you set the course up and maybe how students will execute the work from taking it from the classroom back to their hometowns. But how, what's the genesis?
The genesis of this is a lot of my freshman students have never read the Constitution. And my own kids who the kids of mine who most recently went through high school, they were science deck kids. They hadn't read it. And that seemed to me deeply problematic. And then with the level of discourse we see in our public life, it just seemed that we need to be able to have a debate. And I don't think there's a lot of modeling for debate. I mean, your show's great for doing this, but there aren't a lot of shows like yours. There aren't a lot of media like yours. People speak to friendly audiences or friendly media sources. We don't have a question time like they do in Parliament where you have to engage in debate and defend policies. And I just felt that we needed to do this. And so there's a lot of forces that have shaped American culture that I felt that students needed to read and become familiar with. They need to understand the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, but also the Anti-Federalist Papers. And we've sort of worked the class. How this program works, just to kind of step back, is it's a three-course sequence that's open to freshman students and transfer students when they come into Geneseo. All freshman students. In fact, we want students from all majors, all backgrounds. And for this coming semester, we have that. It's going to be a really exciting and challenging but exciting course to teach. And so we look at the first course, kind of looks at themes of freedom and unfreedom, equality and inequality in American life. It's not strictly a chronological course. The second semester, well, we start talking about how to do research at the local level. We look at themes of citizenship and exclusion and community and individualism, right? And get students doing some reading over time, kind of exploring those issues. And then during the summer break, they go home to their towns. And they look at these questions of justice, equity, equality, democracy, you name it, right? These abstract concepts that form the bedrock of American political identity. And I want them to look at their towns. And I'll give you a specific example where I thought this could work. I was doing work with another project and students, and I was in a town in the far southwestern corner of the state. And I'm talking to these local historians, and there's this big wall. It's a storefront. There's this big wall behind them, and it's filled with knives and machetes and blades. It's quite striking to look at. And it's if I'm looking at you, and I'm not really looking at you. I'm distracted by this display behind you. And after we talked about the things we need to talk about, I said, so what's the deal with this macabre-looking display behind you? And they said, look, it was the such-and-such cutlery company closed down its factory in town. The last 40 jobs have left. The company's still profitable. It's going to make its money elsewhere. But these 40 families have been financially devastated by this. Have they not lost something of their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness by this decision by a multinational corporation to move production overseas? I think so. And it seems to me is that, you know, when you talk to people, and I know you do this for a living, when you talk to people, whatever their politics, whether on the left or the right or wherever, they do feel detached and as if the people in the political system don't know what they're doing mm-hmm. or don't pay attention to them. And what I would like students to see is that they are themselves forces in history, right? That their stories matter, that the connections they have, the communities to which they belong are essential to understanding life in this country, that they can make a difference at the local level. And so we're going to encourage them to go out and write about or in other ways, you know, create art or whatever they want to do as a project to look at these themes of justice, democracy, equality, whatever you have in terms of what's going on in their communities.
I mean, when you think about the way that people feel detached, to Michael's point, to use that word, the way I would describe it is I think a lot of people, no matter your political stripes, feel like representative government, and I don't mean that abstractly, I mean like the people who are elected, don't really relate to you very well, don't really understand your experience very well. And it becomes dangerous, I think, when people become convinced that they not only don't relate, but they don't care, or they're actively hostile toward. What is the possible benefit to a society that feels so detached if projects like this work, Michael?
That's a great question. I think that what we will have at a minimum level is we will have a group of students, and we hope to have this, when this is up and running, we hope to have 25% of our freshman class come through that. That's our target.
That's a lot of A lot of kids, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of kids. We've got 40.
And it's not kids. I mean, I'm using that term in an old guy way.
Right.
Students, young adults, people.
Yeah, 250 students a year moving through this. And at a minimum, what we get out of that is a bunch of well-informed students who've engaged with these significant transformational texts in American life. That's the minimum we get out of this. If they go home and produce something meaningful for their communities that's on display in their communities, or it's on display at our website at Geneseo once we get that up and running, or it's presented in other venues, then we're spreading and sharing this information. And at a minimum, with that informed citizen base and these informed students, we can have some conversations. And as Kathy said earlier, right, we need to be able to have a constructive argument. There are things over which we may disagree politically. And to immediately assume that you're evil because you disagree with me is not going to get us anywhere. So how do we move forward? How do we have an engaged and informed debate, right? The recent Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity, right, where the court held that president is essentially immune to any action taken if it's connected to official duties of his presence. President can't be prosecuted. Well, let's have a discussion about it. Let's have a debate about that. Because the Constitution says punishment can only exceed to, you know, for conviction, it can only extend to removal from office, which implies there's some punishment afterwards, right, for criminal charges. Let's have a discussion about that. Let's have a debate. But we don't really have a venue for that debate. We don't have a place for that to take place. And we don't have, I think, a lot of people, frankly, if they're not reading the Constitution, they're not equipped to have that kind of debate. So that's what I hope we can do. And I really feel this is essential for the Republic, because the things I hear coming out of the political spectrum seem woefully short-sighted and woefully uninformed. And I think that's deeply, deeply dangerous.
Let me follow up one point Michael's making before I turn to his colleagues. You bring up the presidential immunity case. It seems to me that you do not think the level of discourse about that case has been what is required of this moment.
What I would love to have seen someone do is let's put the section from Article 3 of the Constitution. It's Article 2. I'm sorry, Article 2 of the Constitution. I need to read it too. But let's just actually look at what the Constitution says, and let's talk about that actual couple of sentences in the Constitution that deals with impeachment. Let's have a debate and let's explore what it means. I don't think it's been on MSNBC when I occasionally watch it. It hasn't been on CNN. I know that. And it certainly hasn't. I haven't watched Fox News. And with soccer this weekend, I haven't got to watch anything I wanted to watch. But I don't see that kind of discussion taking place. And that's deeply problematic.
So, Kathy, for you, this decision to open up to all students is an interesting one. Mm-hmm. Why not just keep it narrowly focused for students with certain career paths or study paths?
Yeah, that's a good question. I understand that students and parents are very concerned with what our students are going to do after they leave the college. And so the kind of focus on professionalism and almost vocational emphasis, I get that. I understand that because college is expensive and students will eventually need to make some money. But opening this up is more representation of the world that they're going to enter and the kinds of discussions and debates that we hope that they'll have as they continue on in their jobs and wherever they may be in terms of their communities. And so I see this program important because they're not only grappling with these texts, they're not being tested on them per se. This isn't about trying to memorize the Constitution. This is about trying to think about its meaning and related texts as well. While we're mentioning the Constitution here, that's not what this course is only about. They'll be reading, depending on who's teaching the course, they might be reading Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and thinking about AI thinking about parent relationships, child-parent relationships. So I think in terms of this course, we've opened it up to as many people as possible because that's really the society that they're going to live in. And then I also think that mentioning Michael's point about the summer projects, we want students to feel creative. We want them to feel like they're actually building something. And so whether it's a podcast, whether it might be something that's visual, a poster, a placard somewhere. But that gives them a sense of investment in their community and a sense of the kind of empowerment that Michael was talking about, which we hope that they start to feel, because they're the ones who are going to be able to change their society someday.
Hannah, do you feel like opening it up to all students here allows people to understand that this isn't really a societal issue? This should not be just a specialized set of study, that really we all need this kind of education?
Absolutely. I mean, I tell my students, you might not care about politics, but politics cares about you. Mm. And regardless if you're a STEM major, business major, even a political science student, you need to be informed, and kind of what Kathy is getting at too, that when these students go home to their communities, they're helping inform the folks around them. They are our future leaders. And you were talking, Evan, earlier about our government not being representative of the people, right? It's no secret that our members of Congress don't represent demographically the population. And the more students that we can get civically engaged and active, then maybe they're our future members of Congress, and they'll make government more descriptively representative, at least.
The idea of you may not care about politics, but politics cares about you. I find that there's either this idea, and it's not, I don't mean to bifurcate everything very neatly, but some people have this idea of like, I don't care about politics. And everybody knows somebody in their family like, don't talk to me about that. I don't care about politics. Which sometimes is a cop out, and sometimes I think is genuine, but they think, well, I don't have to, I don't want to. I want to insulate my life away from that. I don't care. And then there's people who think they care about politics, but they're just on Newsmax or MSNBC or the worst sort of YouTube sites all day long. And they're marinating in propaganda of one kind or another, but not a lot of really good information. And they still flunk civics. They don't do well when you ask them basic facts here. So, I mean, I'm just kind of painting this picture that's kind of bleak. But I appreciate the approach that is coming from this room that says we have a need. Everybody has a need. But you have to convince young people that there is a need for this, that there's a value in this. I guess you're doing it, Hannah, because people are signing up for the class, right? I mean, how many people have signed up for this?
It's closed right now at 40. I've got about 40 more who want in.
Are you surprised at that?
I'm pleasantly I'm worried that no one's listening right now. I assume no one's going to show up, so I was pleased. We told the funder who's getting us going this year, there's a group called the Teagle Foundation, that our goal would be to get 25 students through the program. So if we're starting with 40, we'll see how it goes. I would love to accommodate them all in this trial run, but we're just still learning how to put the class together. We've spent 3 weeks, 2 weeks talking about a reading list, about 15 of us on campus, some in person, some through email from a distance, because faculty tend to scatter. But we're putting this course together. We're going to have a trial run, and I'm really pleased that it's closed, and I'm really pleased that I've got business majors, science majors, humanities, liberal arts majors. It's going to be a really great mix, and I am so psyched to begin teaching. I mean, I'm really excited to begin teaching this class. I think it's going to be fun. They're going to be reading they will be reading the Declaration and the Constitution. They'll be reading Federalist Papers, Anti-Federalist Papers. They'll be reading Tocqueville, Democracy in America, one of the great French foreign observers of American democracy in the 1800s, Frederick Douglass. I could keep going on and on and on. And we end with Toni Morrison's Beloved this first semester. So it's a wide range of materials they'll be reading. And it's a lot of reading, more reading than they will have done in any high school class.
Do you tell them that beforehand? Because that might get some to not take the class.
I will tell them that morning. And this gets back to our earlier point, Evan. They will do the work if you convince them and explain to them that there's value in the work.
Yeah.
No student signs up for a class and says, I'm hoping to waste the next 15 weeks.
Right.
They come into a class, even if it's a class they have to take, they want to learn something.
So that's incumbent on all of you to convince them that there is value.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That you didn't just put together a syllabus course outline for no purpose for their life.
This is not to entertain me. This is value. And I think that I think that one thing that what I love about Geneseo is I think we have probably more winners of the Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Teaching than any other SUNY college per capita, right? We have fantastic teachers across the board, Hannah's department, our department, and history department, just across the campus. And we have, working on this planning group, we have We have members of the history department. We have political science and international relations, anthropology, sociology. We even have a former dean of the School of Business, a physics professor, all kinds of people involved in putting this course together. And these are all outstanding teachers. And I think that's what's so exciting about it is we've got all this buy-in from a wide range of people across the campus. And that's precisely what we want, right? This is not a history class. It's not a political science class. This is a class where we're talking about the functioning of our democracy. And I think that with the people we have as instructors at Geneseo, with the reading list and with the students we get, we're going to have no problem filling this as it moves forward.
Kathy, when it comes to students, again, here's another stereotype about young people. Nobody reads. They don't read. They don't read books. They don't have an attention span. You hear those stereotypes. Do you agree with Michael that if you convince students that assignments have value, they will do them?
I do. I think that we need to be very careful about how we present courses. And so they need to recognize that they have a responsibility, that the course isn't going to go well unless they're prepared. I think we can help them along with questions. We can help them along by being very open when they do participate. So instead of correcting someone or, chastising them for not knowing what maybe we thought they would have known, you work with what they're bringing to the table. So I think you can set them up. I'm one who loves quizzes, like easy quizzes and lots of questions, just because when I'm looking at new texts, I don't really know where to look either. And so I'm pretty honest with students about that. But I think it's really about the classroom dynamic. And so they know when they come to class that the conversation will be a bit freewheeling, that more people are invited to come into the conversation, that diverse viewpoints are welcome. This isn't just, you know, we all agree with our dear leader. Instead, it's really serious discussions and debates. And I think we also need to be vulnerable ourselves. So I talk to students about my own concerns about the present day without being, quote, political per se, but just being honest. Mm-hmm. I also share with them my own past as a student and the challenges I faced reading and writing. I don't know how many times I've told students the first college paper I wrote, my first paragraph was 4 pages long. And it's because I didn't know how to write. But it wasn't because I didn't care. I cared a lot. I put a lot into that 4-page paragraph. and I use it as an example for students. It's often because they care a lot where the ideas are kind of coming in all different angles and you're trying to tease through those ideas. So I think it's more being part of the class. Obviously, you're directing the conversation, but you're not judging them.
Mm-hmm. I think that what's great about it is this is not going to be a gripe session, these classes, right. But it's asking students, what do you want the world to look like?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we get there? Mm-hmm. And different students will have different answers to that question. That's cool. That's fine. But what do you want this world to look like 5, 10, 20, 30 years from now? And what have other people in the American past said about it? How do we get there? And I think that's where I think we empower the students.
That point that Michael just made, of all things, made me think of an interview I watched last week with Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan. And she was talking about why she was able to succeed politically in a state where her predecessor, Republican, there was a lot of political winds blowing in Republicans' favor in Michigan. And she's in her second term now. But she said that they have done a lot of work with big principles in mind about why are we doing what we're doing, who does it affect, and one of the most important things that they do is they are always asking themselves, is what we are doing going to make young adults want to live here? What do they want from the government and the world that they live in? What is our responsibility in that? And does our policy and our work reflect something that they would find that they want for their state, for their country, for their future? And she's specific about young adults, the youngest adults, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. What do they want from the world? Are we providing that? Because she said a lot of younger people vote in lower numbers, and a lot of people in politics are not very young, and they don't really think about that cohort. Well, Mike, what you're saying is you created a class, but part of what you're going to be talking about is talking to students directly about how do you see the world? Like, what do you want from it? Why is it not working the way that you want it? It sounds like, at least in part, an active dialogue.
Active and as the semesters go on, an increasingly informed dialogue as they learn more about what's been tried in the past and what's been talked about in the past. And I think what they'll see is that there are a lot of things that they want that have been thought about and wished for and called for over the years, and that we can engage with those people from the past and I think approach the problems we're facing and the problems that they perceive that they're facing in a more constructive and creative and hopefully effective way.
Well, again, as the resident youngest person on the panel, Hannah Brandt, is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at SUNY Geneseo. You can't speak for all younger people. You can only speak for yourself. But do you feel that students maybe perform better or engage more when they actually feel like when they're coming to a class, it's not just one direction of where dialogue or instruction or conversation is coming from, that they're actually part of it?
Yeah, absolutely, especially when you're trying to get them to buy into your course and buy into this whole college experience, that when you make those personal connections with the students in the classroom, you're fostering a sense of community, of belonging. And I think that's what's so great about this American Cornerstones Project and Geneseo as a whole, is that students who are participating in the program have a built-in learning community that they can collaborate with their peers, with Dr. Oberg, and that they're able to grow emotionally and socially through this experience. That helps their academic performance when they feel like they have a sense of belonging and that their participation makes a difference.
When we come back from this only break, I'm going to prove to Michael Oberg that people are listening because we've got some questions from listeners. So people are very interested. We're talking to Michael Oberg, distinguished professor in the Department of History at SUNY Geneseo, Hannah Brandt, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at SUNY Geneseo, and their chair of the Department of History is Kathleen Mapes. And we're going to come right back with some of your feedback as we talk about the American Cornerstones Project next. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. We welcome Mary Lupien and Kim Smith from Rochester City Council. They voted no on the recent budget. Last week, you heard Mayor Malik Evans and some members of council who supported the budget and its priorities. You're going to hear from some members of council. Equal time offered for them to make the case that we should go in a different direction. That's Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me grab a phone call first. We'll get some emails in a moment. Susan in Canandaigua. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi there, Evan. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Just two things. They're very separate. I happen to be a middle school teacher, so I picked up on the comment about K-12 education, and it felt a little critical. We're up against a lot right now, and yeah, I know you guys are completely thrilled with your older kids. It's tough right now, and parent perspective and parent involvement, not always in a great way, makes it super challenging. So that's just one thing. And then the other thing, I thought it was really interesting, your three guests, two are female, one is male. The male is much more optimistic about like our political future. And that makes real sense to me because men aren't losing their rights. And that's more of a comment. And I'll take comments off the air. Thanks so much, Evan.
Susan, thank you for the phone call. I'll just say, first of all, this is a sample size of three. It's not a scientific sample. And Michael has always been very optimistic. He's also very... He is a champion of young people in a way that I have really rarely seen, and in a way that I would evaluate as authentic. I'll let our guests respond to the idea that, well, you know, the man, it's easy to, for the man to be optimistic.
Thanks for your call, Susan. In no way would I diminish the efforts and the work you do in the classroom K-12. And I'm married to a teacher. I know very well the obstacles you guys
face.
They
are up against a lot, aren't they?
You guys should be put in the same talk with first responders and people like that. Absolutely. You guys are essential. I think a lot of what's going on, I'm critical of in terms of K-12 education as curricular matters and stuff that's being imposed upon students and you yourselves in terms of what you deliver and how you deliver it. I think that's where we see a problem. And look, I'm optimistic about young people and the students and the capacity of young people to make our community a better place. I find our political system as dark a place as it's been in many, many years. The assaults on rights of all kinds of people are dangerous. I fear that they're going to get worse. I fear they could get worse in the immediate short term, even before the election. I think we have significant challenges. So I totally hear what you're saying about the judicial and judicial assault on women's rights, but all kinds of things where we have this growing intolerance and this if you measure the justice of society by how well it treats its most vulnerable members, we are doing pretty badly. And one hope of this program is that students will approach people who aren't like them, whether that's culturally or demographically or socially or politically, with some empathy and respect. And that lack of empathy and that lack of understanding is so toxic. So I totally hear you. I think we'd agree on almost everything, Susan. So,
Kathy, you want to add anything there?
I would say that I know Michael wasn't meaning to disrespect at all K-12. I think sometimes we're unaware of what's going on in K-12. So recently I created a course to help future teachers think about social studies in new ways, to bring in new ways of understanding the past and history. And they often say to me, maybe she don't have a clue in terms of the challenges that they're going to face with the regents, with parents, with administrators, with all that they need to cover. And so I think we're becoming more aware of our own students by thinking about what they're going to be doing afterwards. So I take that maybe she don't have a clue seriously and have tried to learn from them, but also push them to think about how they're teaching slavery or how they're teaching the progressive era, because that speaks to the issues that we're discussing today. The historical understanding of the past, if it's based in myths of manifest destiny, we're in big trouble. But if they can start to push their students to appreciate the complexity of the past, then I think we'll be better overall.
Hannah, do you want to add to that?
I mean, as far as, you know, the two women on the panel being less optimistic, I think the caller might be, you know, getting at something there a little bit. And that, you know, there's an increasing gender gap in who's turning out to vote, and women are turning out to vote at higher rates over time across all spectrums, demographic, education levels. And that's really great. And that, you know, a backlash effect can be politically motivating for some folks.
Let me get to some email. Gary says, Evan, in addition to the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers, which are partisan arguments during the ratification process, a reading of the Constitutional Convention minutes and debates is helpful. The minutes of the debates shed light on the thinking that went behind the Constitution. People may be surprised how the framers favored a republic and feared a direct democracy. It's why they wanted a Senate to be selected by delegates and not by direct democracy. Indeed, in the closing remarks, there is a warning about democracy being mob rule, the same danger as populism. Do your guests think that perhaps we've gone too far with direct democracy instead of a republican form of government? Another good example is the results of the RNC and DNC primaries. That's from Gary. Michael, you want to start? What do you think?
No, I don't think we've gone too far. I think we need more direct democracy. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you make of his invoking the minutes and debates?
Yeah, I think we have it. That is on our reading. We have a reading list of probably, 200 items, I think, is a potential thing. And we require that faculty choose 50% of their readings. At least 50% of the readings have to come from this list. So we want to create a community. So when we have multiple sections of this course down the road, there will be some shared reading, and students from across different sections of the class, as they move through their years at the college, will be able to harken back to things they've read. And certainly the Madison's notes on the Philadelphia Convention are one of those essential documents. The trick is, though, that we have 15 weeks, 8 hours a week with the students, and you can't read everything. And so we have to be judicious about what we choose. So they're not reading all the Federalist Papers. Like, I'm not going to have them read all of them. They're not going to read all the Anti-Federalists, the voluminous Anti-Federalist writings. But we're doing sampling. But we are doing some books in their entirety. Gary's absolutely right. The Madison's notes are essential. They're really valuable documents. But there's lots of really valuable documents. And one of the things we want to do is give the faculty from different disciplines on campus some freedom to choose things where they feel they can be most effective as instructors.
Why a more direct democracy and not more of a Republican kind of?
Well, I think what we see is a lot of people who feel that their voices don't matter, right? I mean, that's what I think is where we're going to lose a lot of young people. You ask, I know I ask, my oldest kid is 30, coming on 36, and my youngest has just turned 14. And you listen to them talk about politics, and it's like their views, they view that their voice doesn't matter at all. They heard mention made to issues that matter to them deeply during the primary season, student debt especially. A lot of that has been blocked and defeated, and their sense is that, you know, we point out when I went to college, it was $350 a semester. I could work a minimum wage job and pay for my college, right? You can't do that now. It's just impossible. And so their point would be very fairly that people like me in my late 50s don't understand the world they're going into. And I think, frankly, that's an incredibly significant accusation they're throwing at our representative bodies in both the national and state level. They don't know. They don't act like they know. And if you lose these young people, that's a big loss.
So an extension of this question that Gary is raising is, if we see the Democratic Party convince Joe Biden that he shouldn't be running, and next month at the convention, a new ticket is chosen, that will not be a direct democracy. That will be more of the, you know, the delegates will be choosing. It'll be potentially 2,000 or fewer people.
Sure.
Is that going to endanger the Democratic Party's position with voters who feel like they should have more of a direct say?
I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, I don't do the future very well. But,
You're a historian. You're not a futurist.
Yeah, I'm not. But I don't know what the stake would be. But I think that it would be nice to have some political leaders under 75 at the national level. I want to vote for people younger than me.
Okay. Kathy, what do you make of Gary's points about you know, how you choose the reading list? Are you comfortable with, you know, Michael's describing a hard situation where there's so much that you want students to be able to consume. You've got to be judicious in how you approach that. Are you comfortable that you're going to find that right mix?
No, definitely, definitely. Because it's about the conversations that you're having. So it's not a matter of everyone sticking to exactly the same 10 texts over the course of a semester. Obviously, half their texts need to come from this predetermined list, but then we expect people to bring in their own interests, their specializations, things that are outside of what we've thought of as the most important texts at this particular moment in time in terms of thinking about the past. So I'm perfectly fine with that. I think that's important to get faculty buy-in as well, because a course like this, we don't want it to become a rote course where people just do it because it's a requirement, the students take it because it's a requirement. It really needs to be a special opportunity to experience college in a new way, especially the first semester. So it is about discussion, debate, dialogue, better understanding, but mostly community, because I think that students coming in, they often lack a sense of community. And we can build that in the classroom. I think those are some of the strongest bonds students can form with each other.
So let me play the role of a student in your class.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to challenge an idea here. So it's been presented that we need more direct democracy and not less. And I'm going to take Gary's position and say, but hey, professor, isn't it true that you've been challenging us to think about how a society, a country, a government treats the least of its citizens or the most vulnerable of its citizens, put it that way. And if we're not doing that well, isn't that an indictment of the mob rule that some of the founders worried about? And shouldn't we have less direct democracy?
Wait, I'm trying to understand your logic here.
If we're majority rule, plurality rule,
okay,
you know, the most vulnerable tend to be
outside
of the plurality.
Right.
And if they are to be ignored or their rights not to be considered because the majority gets their way all the time, is that an indictment of direct democracy?
Well, direct democracy in election doesn't then determine the Constitution, doesn't change the laws, you know, so there are other built-in, hopefully, fingers crossed, safety nets, you might say, for that. So that's obviously the tension between majority rule, minority rights. I mean, that's been the tension forever. But in terms of this whole notion of direct democracy, I mean, did we even have anything like that until 1965? I mean, seriously, like, I constantly think about, why do I refer to the U.S. as a democracy before 1965 when large swaths of the population simply weren't allowed to vote? So I don't, it's an odd debate to me right now.
Okay. Like, do you want to tackle that?
If the polls hold like where they're at now, it's very likely that we'll have a president elected in a couple of months that will have a majority of the Electoral College and a minority of the mm-hmm. popular vote. Something that's happened a couple of times since, 2000, right?
Yeah.
And you ask, go into a classroom of 18 to 22-year-olds and say, how do you feel about this, about the wisdom of the founding fathers? And they think it's a crock of BS, that this is a terrible system. It's unfair, it's unjust, and it's wrong. We can just say, well, James Madison and those guys were brilliant, and I don't think there's any evidence that they were on this one, right? They made a lot of short-sighted things. The whole Three-Fifths Compromise and the fact that they had to have a civil war 80 years after they put it together suggests that they didn't. There was some shortcomings in some of their logic. But look, if take the Supreme Court, the most recent term, where you have just these nine people, well, six, mostly 6-3 votes, right, and a lot of these things, where you're taking positions that just defy the will of most Americans, whether it's abortion rights or whatever the case, where a vast majority of Americans favor having access to legalize abortion, right? If you don't respect this disaffection with the undemocratic nature of our system and say, well, this is all fine, it's working well, we have the greatest constitutional system in the world, in my view, you're not approaching it critically and honestly. And look, if a student wants to say, come through the course, say, this is the greatest constitutional world, fine, that's awesome, fantastic. But we're going to challenge the assumptions. And they're going to challenge my assumptions that there's flaws in the system. And that's where we both grow. And I think one of the things, I think Kathy mentioned it earlier, and Hannah mentioned as well, I think, so we learn a lot from our students. And this is a kind of course that requires us to go back to the books and read a lot of books that we may not have read or we haven't read since grad school or undergraduate school. It's a real stretch for those of us who are teaching it. And for my colleague who's a physics professor and the school dean of school business, they're taking wider strides than we are. But we all learn from these discussions. And that to me is one reason why it's such an exciting course to teach, is I'm going to learn a lot as I read these books, as I share them with a bunch of young, optimistic people who are ready to make change.
Let me squeeze in one more listener comment. See, listeners, Michael.
Yeah.
There's lots of
That's my problem, not anyone else's.
Tina says, can you ask the guests if they're including reading by Isabel Wilkerson's Cast and or the mm-hmm. film Origins by Ava DuVernay based on Wilkerson's book? Could fit in well in understanding inequality, racism, and the caste system in the United States.
I don't think those are on the list. I wish Wilkerson had a very short version of The Warmth of Other Suns, which I think is the best book I've read on the Great Migration ever. Caste, I wasn't as big a fan of. I think that there are some big leaps made in that book, but I would definitely love if there were a 200-page version of The Warmth of Other Suns. It would be brilliant.
One thing we're doing, Evan, is we're trying to stay away from scholars and social scientists in their reading. And we're not reading scholarly monographs. We want students to read texts. So we'll be reading, the Port Huron Statement about student activism. We're reading what people active at the time have said and texts that were important at the time, Michael Harrington's Other America or all kinds of things like that. What we're getting, we want to kind of read these classic important texts.
Listeners asking what our guests think, should we be requiring elected representatives to pass a civics course?
The citizenship test? We did a show on this.
Yes.
I would love to see them pass the citizenship test.
I think it shouldn't. I don't think it should be required to get into office, but I think if you want, before you get into office, I think you should have to take the test publicly. And your results will be public. And you can still have the office that you want if you want. But if you do poorly, you'll be a meme on social media at a minimum, and you might be inspired to learn more or to take SUNY Geneseo's course. You might have an influx of students. They might be elected representatives. How well do you think elected leaders would do on civics tests? What do you think, Kathy?
Oh, goodness. I honestly don't know.
She's trying to be very diplomatic. Michael?
I haven't spoken to any, right? They don't call me. I mean, the system is undemocratic enough. I don't have access to them. Wait, you don't even, you're a journalist. You don't even get to ask them questions. questions.
There are some who will not answer any questions. Yeah. Some are fabulous in that they're very accessible, but some somewhere in the middle. Hannah, what do you think? Do you think, I wonder if I don't know if we can force representatives to pass the civics course. Is there a part of you that would just like, just for the kind of the pleasure of seeing them have to do it publicly, would you enjoy that?
Oh, I would love it. I would love it.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. Listen, I've really appreciated the conversation this hour. A lot of great feedback from listeners. People are very concerned about this. People are concerned about civics. They're concerned about civic engagement. They're concerned about understanding our history and how that relates to their communities today. That's what this is all about, and that's why SUNY Geneseo has created the American Cornerstones Project. It's open to all students. Maybe you come back after the first year and tell us how it's gone. Bring a couple students. What do you think?
Absolutely.
You're all invited. So let's bookmark this for next summer, and I can't wait to meet some of the students who are in the first cohort. Michael Oberg, Distinguished Professor in the Department of History at SUNY Geneseo. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome, Evan.
Kathy Mapes. Kathleen is Chair of the Department of History at SUNY Geneseo. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Hannah Brent, Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at SUNY Geneseo. Great having you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. No civics tests today. Maybe on a future program. We'll be back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.